From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Antidepressants are big business. One in eight Americans use them. Some prominent medical studies in recent years suggest they may not work. Psychiatrist and best-selling author Peter Kramer told us to listen to Prozac in the 1990s and says antidepressants still work. But are they misused, overprescribed, good for kids? This hour on Point, the case for and possibly against antidepressants. You can join us on air or online. Do you have depression? Do antidepressants work for you? Is there too much stigma around this disease and its treatments? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me from New York is Peter Kramer, psychiatrist and clinical professor emeritus of psychiatry and human behavior at Brown University. He's the author of many books, including Listening to Prozac and Against Depression. His new book is called Ordinarily Well, The Case for Antidepressants. And you can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Later in the hour, we'll speak to a renowned child psychologist and researcher to hear the big debate in her field about giving antidepressants to young people. Welcome to On Point, Peter Kramer. Nice to have you.
Hello.
So your landmark book, Listening to Prozac, was a national bestseller. You've now waded into the contentious debate about the efficacy of antidepressants. What's the message of your book?
It's that these medicines work. They work about as well as most interventions that doctors and other specialties use. And that the case for placebo, the case that these medicines are a little more than dummy pills with side effects, is overblown and probably simply wrong.
You said you wrote the book reluctantly. Reluctantly. Why?
Well, I'm, you know, too associated with these medicines. I consider myself a general writer about different cultural issues that occur at the interface of psychiatry and problems that we have. So I've written about couples and divorce, intimacy, identity. And in a way, the writing about Prozac or psychotherapy is sort of incidental to those issues. In my mind, this was really a different book. I had started to have patients who had really been helped, in my view, by antidepressants come in and say, I've read that these are just placebos. Should I be on them? And then there was really a quite scary episode. A friend of mine had a serious stroke of a kind that has been known to respond in terms of people regaining movement after the stroke to antidepressants. And the neurologist was reluctant to prescribe because he'd read so many debunking articles about antidepressants. And really, I and a physician relative of this friend weighed in and said, you know, you have to look at the research. The research is good. Doesn't have a direct connection with depression, but I thought somebody has to speak up and say, no, the research really says that these drugs work. And the debunking research, you know, is sort of gadfly material. It was an attempt, I think, largely by people who favor psychotherapy, which, by the way, I do as well, to pull back on the reins of pharmacologists. But it doesn't really stand up as research.
Well, let's talk about the research, because there have been a lot of studies recently by some, you know, eminent scientists that cast doubt on the effectiveness of antidepressants. Why are you wearing those studies? Why?
Well, there was one published in JAMA, you know, which is an eminent place.
Yes.
You'd think well-reviewed. And this is the one that led a lot of the press to say that antidepressants don't work, say, for mild depression. Well, this was an anticipated study. There have been some earlier studies suggesting, and I think these were contentious as well, that antidepressants didn't work for mild depression, but they didn't actually have mildly depressed patients in them. This was sort of extrapolation of some curves on a graph. So this new study supposedly had people with mild depression in it. Well, it did, and this is sort of technical material, but at the mild end, the main study that included people with mild depression, the researchers, for reasons they argued for, had gotten rid of the patients who responded. There are various ways of subdividing depression, but there's a category called dysthymia, which is chronic minor depression, and that responds very well to antidepressants. And the reason it, quote, responds well, all low-level depression responds in doctor's offices, is that people with chronic depression don't usually respond to placebo. They've seen everything. It's a hard-to-treat condition. So in the drug trials, which compare people on medicine with people on placebo, you see the effects very strongly if the placebo effects are low. Well, because dysthymia sort of had a different name, it was eliminated from this study. So for severe depression, you had chronic depression, you had acute depression. But for the mild depression, you only had people with acute depression in the study, so that you'd predict in advance that the placebo effects would be higher in that, in those people. And then, you know, when you looked at this study further, there were actually only six trials in it. Some of them had fairly low levels of antidepressant or unknown, unpublished levels of antidepressant. And those were in the moderate range. So you had effective treatment and a good patient sample in the severe range. And as you went down the severity spectrum, the trial got more and more suspect. And, you know, nobody who's seen antidepressants work and who sees that kind of study is all of a sudden going to say, my goodness, I'm convinced they don't work in mild or moderate depression. Well, shortly after, a group at Columbia, New York State Psychiatric Institute, who'd actually treated lots of patients in drug trials, patients who had mild and moderate major depression, the category that was of interest, published a roundup of six of their studies. And the numbers were almost identical to the response rates in severe depression, so that when you actually had patients with a disorder and looked at a full sample, the antidepressants looked equally effective up and down the line.
We will dig into a lot of aspects of your research, including the history of antidepressants and all of it. But I want you to set the table for us with that preface. As you say in your book, depression is a serious, progressive, and destructive illness. Help us understand the scope of the problem. How many Americans suffer with depression today?
You know, the numbers in research range from, you know, 6-7% to 12% with major depression. This is serious depression, and that's not, you know, at any given moment, but over the course of a year, a number of people will pass in and out of major depression. And actually, I'm not sure I have the numbers right even, but it's in that range.
And how many require medication?
This is the category that responds to medication. It responds to psychotherapy as well. I mean, it's not the, you know, another point of my book, I have to say, is how we treat evidence is very important. That we're in this era of evidence-based medicine, and the question is, do we automatically in lockstep respond to every trial that comes along and change our practice, or are doctors allowed to use their judgment? So that, you know, say that it's on the order of 8 or 10% of people have kinds of depression that might respond to antidepressants. That doesn't mean doctors have to take out the prescription pad the moment the patient walks into the office. And some of these disorders remit on their own. But, you know, if depression lasts, if it is serious enough, it needs to be treated in a way that makes it remit. And the reason is that this turns out to be a destructive multi-system disorder. First of all, having depression now predicts you'll have more and harder to treat depression later if the current depression isn't treated. But there also are disruptions to your hormonal glands, there are disruptions in blood elements, there's disruption in bone formation. So this is a general multi-system disease, and once it gets started, it gets harder and harder to interrupt. So, you know, we do like to see it treated, and I think however it's treated, the measure that the treatment is the right one is that the depression responds.
What's the difference, doctor, between sadness, melancholy, and true clinical depression?
Well, depression is a syndrome, so people with depression tend to have problems with memory and concentration. They have low energy. They don't enjoy things. They may be apathetic. They have problems with sleep and appetite, and they may be suicidal. So this is a cluster of findings that seems to be a disorder, and, you know, when you look into it, there's a genetics to it, not well formulated, but, you know, it's runs in families. It's one of these complicated disorders like diabetes that responds to things that people do as well. Stress causes depression. But, you know, sadness is more intermittent. And, I mean, there are all kinds of technical ways of differentiating depression from sadness. But the truth is we kind of know that in the early studies, the early uses of these medicines when they were first developed, depression was really diagnosed through the doctor's gut call. The doctor would sit with the patient, you know, hour after hour, many times a day or many times in the week, and finally say, this person is depressed. Some of it was empathetic. The doctor felt depressed in the patient's presence. It was the leadenness. It was the duration. And that was when the very earliest medicines in the late 1950s were used. And they turned out to be effective. In some ways, our current studies that use more mechanical ways of measuring depression are more suspect.
You write that antidepressants are less often miracle cures, but rather they are useful tools to help troubled people feel better, which you say you've seen in your medical practice over decades. Is there one story before we go to break here in our last minute that expresses that message of your book?
Yeah, I had a patient come in who had read Listening to Prozac, and she said, you know, I'm like those patients. And I think she wasn't really like those patients. She was probably more afflicted than some of the patients I'd written about in Listening to Prozac, and that was a book where I'd noted that some people on medicine, once they recovered, also were more confident, more assertive. She wanted that effect. And I put her on medication. She did very well. And what happened was she started encouraging family members. This was a large family that seemed to have a history of depression to get treated, and there was a sense of really changing a large family culture through the adoption of medication.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're hearing today a defense of antidepressants in a time when many medical studies suggest they may not work. A defense from a psychiatrist who believes in them, who says he's seen the results in his practice. You can join the conversation. What's the difference between a rough patch in life and real depression? Have you taken antidepressants? Do they work? Have you tried alternative therapies? My guest this hour, Peter Kramer, psychiatrist and professor of psychiatry and human behavior at Brown University. His new book is called Ordinarily Well, The Case for Antidepressants. Here's part of a commercial for the antidepressant Cymbalta. An actress describes how it feels to be depressed and says Cymbalta can help.
When you're depressed, where do you want to go? Nowhere. Who do you feel like seeing? No one. Depression hurts in so many ways. Sadness, loss of interest, anxiety. Cymbalta can help.
And here's the last part of that same ad. Only the first 24 seconds of the commercial is actually about selling the product, and the remainder of the ad, a full 50 seconds, is a fast readout of all the possible side effects for adults and especially for kids.
Tell your doctor right away if your depression worsens, you have unusual changes in behavior, or thoughts of suicide. Antidepressants can increase these in children, teens, and young adults. Cymbalta is not approved for children under 18.
Dr. Kramer, you say these medications work, and for many people they do, but there are also significant side effects, are there not?
There are. Let me start by saying I'm not a fan of direct-to-consumer advertising. You know, there are too many ways to influence people, and even if the words are correct, which often they're not, the effect of this advertising is to push people to ask for things they may not need. On the other hand, you know, there is this modest upside, which is that people are more aware of depression and more likely to ask their doctor about it. Yes, when I say that these medicines are ordinary, I mean they have ordinary benefits, as I say, at a level of a lot of interventions we're happy to use in medicine, and they have side effects. The immediate side effects of the newer antidepressants, the ones that have been with us just 20 rather than 50 or 60 years, tend to be mild. What was new and useful about these medicines largely was that people tolerate them well. They don't feel drugged. They don't feel medicated. But all kinds of things can go wrong. The one we're most aware of is people can become more rather than less suicidal on the medicines. And people who've never felt suicidal impulses before can report them, and they can be quite urgent. This is fairly unusual. I haven't seen much of it. But, you know, with long-term use, some people gain weight. There are hints of problems with people being more prone to fall, traffic accidents, broken bones, and then many, many less usual but very severe side effects. So people really need to be monitored when they're on these medicines. And nowadays, more than in the past, some people sometimes are on the medicines for a long time.
So you say the benefits, even hearing all of that, outweigh the negative effects.
Well, if we had a discussion of a heart drug or drug for asthma or whatever the list would be, you know, would be similarly extensive. Yes, I would say these are generally well tolerated, and depression is not a trivial disorder. We're talking about, you know, the level of depression that we discussed in the earlier segment.
Can you help us understand the stigma attached not only to depression, but to the medications used to treat it? This idea that somehow depression is not as serious as any other physical problem. You know, I should be able to pick myself up by my bootstraps and will myself to get well. You know, you wouldn't say to someone, just try harder, your diabetes will go away.
Right.
Talk about that a little bit.
Well, the more I looked at this research literature, the more I thought we would not have this discussion if this were cardiology or pulmonary medicine. You know, there's a maintenance literature. How well do people do if they've done well on medicine and they stay on it versus if they come off? And this isn't to say people should be on medicine indefinitely. But wherever it's been studied, whether for weeks, months, years, people on antidepressants, and these are generally people who have had serious recurrent depression, sometimes life-threatening, they are 2 and 3 times as likely to relapse off medicine as on. And there's a big debate over this literature, you know, is it reliable, is it not reliable? And I think in any other specialty, when there was, you know, there was actually one summary that looked at 9,000 patients in 54 studies. And not only was this maintenance better for people on medicine across the studies, but every individual study, all 54, showed the benefit. And, you know, I think psychiatry is such a divided field, behavioral health, between psychiatry, psychology, social work, nursing. It's such a diverse field, and there's such strong views that we have debates about things that, you know, would just be givens. And I think at the base of this, you know, this is the theme of my prior book 10 years ago, Against Depression, is that we are very uneasy calling depression an illness. Mm-hmm. Despite what I've said about blood elements, bones, and so on, there's a sense that melancholy is part of the human condition, that it recognizes what the human condition really is, which is tragic, that it is associated with creativity and so on. And I think that viewpoint plus a great belief that change in mental conditions should come through self-understanding has really stacked the deck against biological treatments, against, you know, popular and even professional recognition of the benefits of biological interventions in depression.
What about the study a couple of years ago in the Journal of Psychotherapy and Psychosomatics that found nearly 2/3 of a sample of more than 5,000 patients who'd been given a diagnosis of depression within the previous 12 months at that point did not meet the criteria for major depressive episode? You know, what is the misuse of medication, the overprescription of medication?
Well, you know, I have a chapter on that, and I think it may be the same study. And I have two different ways of looking at the study. One was people looked at it in Baltimore, and they said, you know, how many people had never met criteria for major depression or a few anxiety disorders that they considered relevant, you know, to prescribing. And then someone else looked at a national version of the same study, but with a more generous view toward what doctors might or might not be doing. And it turned out many of these patients had had past psychiatric hospitalizations. They had extraordinary stressors. They'd been raped recently, you know, whatever it was. So that if you cast a slightly broader net, what doctors were doing looked more reasonable. Now, just now, since I've written the book, there's a study out of Canada. And for a certain group of doctors, they didn't let their prescriptions come into effect unless the doctor provided a diagnosis. So you had to actually write down something to justify you're giving the antidepressant. And in that sample, if you look at the reasons for giving antidepressants, first of all, most of them were quite conventional. They were these serious anxiety disorders or major depression and so on. Mm-hmm. But the remaining ones were sort of low-dose depression, antidepressant use probably for things like long-track pain. There's certain kinds of neurological pain where these medicines are useful. There were certain kinds of insomnia, especially in addicted patients. People sometimes use antidepressants as sedatives because they're less addicting rather than conventional sedatives. So that if you looked at the list of what these Canadian doctors were saying they were doing, there was extraordinary justification for the medication's use. Now, that isn't to say that there isn't overprescribing. I think, you know, there are areas of American medicine that just are not good altogether. Nursing home care, so-called Medicaid and Medicare mills. I mean, there are doctors who are not doing careful prescribing. In my practice, I'm in an urban Ivy League, middle-class neighborhood practice in Providence, Rhode Island. I really don't see egregious, outrageous prescribing. The patients come in and I think, well, I wouldn't have chosen that drug, or I'd take the patient off faster. But the indications for treatment seem to me fairly solid. So I don't know exactly where to come down on this issue. But there are other actually recent studies that show we're probably not in a crisis as regards doctors' judgment.
So many callers here, Peter Kramer. Let's get a few in. Jennifer in Franklin, Tennessee. Jennifer, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hi, Jane. I just wanted to provide a little anecdotal evidence regarding the effectiveness of antidepressants. Over the last 9 years, I've been off and on antidepressants, mostly on. The first one I tried was Cymbalta. It worked pretty well, but it made me feel really stupid. Like, I was just in a fog all the time, so I just had to get away from that one. So then I tried Lexapro, two different dosages. And the main effect of that was weight gain, so that was not very good. So finally, my doctor suggested Wellbutrin. And after only about a week, I woke up one morning and I was like, oh, yeah, this is what normal is like. I had completely forgotten. And it's not like, you know, I'm over the moon euphoric all the time, but it brought me right back to normal. Like, I feel like a human being again. Now, conversely, I have a friend who tried Wellbutrin and it had the complete opposite effect. It was horrible, and so she had to take a different drug. So I think really the effectiveness of the drug can depend on the person.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Jennifer. Thank you. Peter Kramer, every brain chemistry is different. Try again,
yes.
Right?
Well, I think one reason that practicing doctors are not usually great believers in placebo effect to explain the effect of these antidepressants is you have people who have perfectly good reason to believe in this or that treatment. They don't respond. And then there's this sort of lock and key effect that has where the quality of response is just different. And that, you know, that's really what you just heard. I do try in the book to give some hints for how doctors choose one medication over another. But those, you know, are not well established. They're things we need to be better at.
Here's Julia in Nashville, Tennessee. Julia, welcome to the program. Hi.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I was calling also to kind of give some support and some personal experience with using antidepressants. I'm a nurse practitioner, so I do care for and treat patients with depression, but I also suffer from the condition myself. In my first line of treatment for myself and for my patients is always going to be psychotherapy. That's always first. A lot of times psychotherapy, and I think I remember you saying that also, Dr. Kramer, it's effective alone. However, with myself, after months of psychotherapy, I just could not feel like myself again. I couldn't get up. I couldn't get motivated, getting things done that I need to do. I'm a wife. I'm a mother. I'm a student, and I'm also working. And I just couldn't get it done. I was in a very, very bad place. So with the addition of antidepressants, I've definitely been able to pretty much return back to my normal activity. It wasn't an easy task. It's never been an easy road. And even with my patients, I explained to them that it's an inexact science. One medication is not going to be best for you, just like it may not be best for another patient. However, you know, with a little bit of patience and cooperation and constant follow-up, bringing my patients back in every 2 weeks or at least every 4 weeks to check in with them, see how they're doing, are they sleeping, is their anxiety any better, you know, comparing and contrasting their own personal experiences and complaints, then we're able to take pretty good care of them.
Julie, thank you so much there in Nashville. Peter Kramer, I mean, a couple of great points there. Psychotherapy in combination with medication really is most effective. But I also wonder, you know, these medications are not meant to be used forever. And is there fear among patients that you've worked with and among the studies that you've looked at that suggests that, I don't want to go off of it because I'm scared of what will happen?
Right. Let me back up to one of Julia's other points, which is quality of life, that the early doctors who used these medicines weren't so much using symptom scales. They were looking at patients' restoration of quality of life. Were they able to work? Were they able to raise their kids? Did they like reading books? And, did they participate in athletic activities? And when you look at those scales, the quality of life scales, which were developed more for, drugs in the rest of medicine or treatments in the rest of medicine, antidepressants return patients to the quality of life that their neighbors have. They have an ordinary quality of life, which is, really remarkable given where the patients sometimes start. In terms of long-term use, it's very hard to study long-term use. So we're really relying a great deal on judgment. And there are both, good reasons to keep people on. There are people who haven't functioned well for a long time. They're functioning well now. They've been suicidal. They're able to take on stressors, challenges. Mm-hmm. And those patients, I think, doctors taper slowly or rarely. In my own practice, I take people off medicine more than the objective evidence suggests is safe. And we do pretty well. There's a literature, especially in medical diseases, of antidepressants and what's called rescue. That is, when someone goes on an interferon, which is a medicine that causes depression frequently, mm-hmm. Some doctors pre-medicate those patients with antidepressants, and some wait till they see the first signs of depression, and they go in with what's called rescue, full dose of medicine, right away. And both seem to work. So the alternative I try to use in my practice is to try to get patients off medicine very gradually often, follow them, reasonably closely. And I don't make patients off medicine who are not in psychotherapy come in all the time. But with good training about what to look for, their relatives should know what to look mm-hmm. for, and the possibility of stepping in quickly.
Just a couple of minutes till a break here, Peter Kramer. You write that because of antidepressant medication, we don't see the really serious depression of years past, that the end-of-line depression that you saw in your medical training in the 1970s is different. Tell me what you mean by that.
This is the most controversial thing I've written in the book, and I apologize for it throughout the chapter. I've been taken to task for this claim. But when I was in medical school, on the medical wards, forget the psychiatric wards where this was endemic, but on the medical wards, you would have patients come in who'd never been treated with medication, although the medicines had been around for, 15 years anyway. And they would be sitting in the bed, wringing their hands. They'd look like a, Picasso Blue Period or Albrecht Dürer print version of depression. They were thin. They were starving. They were not thinking well. And nobody would have treated these patients. And I think nowadays it's not just that we give those patients medicine. It's that we don't see those patients very often. Now, because I conduct an outpatient practice, I didn't rely on my observation. For years, I've been asking medical students, residents, when I interact with them, and doctors who treat very severe depression, what they see. I have a close colleague who does what's called neuromodulation, things with, magnets and electricity that are used in extreme cases of depression to get people back on track. And she said that she rarely sees this old-style classic end-stage depression. And a specialist on psychotic depression said to me that outside of the psychotic depression, it's the same thing, much less end-stage depression. And we think it's because we interrupt depression before it gets to that point.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we are hearing the big debate about antidepressants this hour. 1 in 8 Americans uses them, and experts do not agree if they're really that effective. You can join the conversation. Why is a brain disease or a brain disorder any different from any other medical issue? Are we stigmatizing depression by questioning if the medications work? Here's a clip from a 2012 movie, Silver Lining Playbook. Tiffany, played to a T by Jennifer Lawrence, and Pat, also played by Bradley Cooper, fall in love. Both suffer from mental illness. Here they bond over their medication.
I was on Xanax and Effexor, but I agree, it wasn't as sharp, so I stopped.
You ever take Klonopin?
Klonopin, yeah.
Right?
Jesus.
Like, is it what?
Yeah.
What day is it? How about Trazodone?
Trazodone.
Oh, it flattens you out. I mean, you are done. It takes the light right out of your eye.
My guest this hour, Peter Kramer, psychiatrist and author of the new book, Ordinarily Well, The Case for Antidepressants. Peter Kramer, a couple of important questions here, emailed from our listeners. Diana and Paul in Cambridge, please ask your guest to disclose any funding that he has received and the research projects that he cites receive money from pharmaceutical companies.
None. I actually am on a very short list. The British Medical Journal had a list of journalists and investigative reporters paid by drug companies and are qualified to speak to the press about these issues. There were six psychiatrists named, and I'm one of the six.
Diana and Paul, thanks for those questions. Let me bring in now Maria Kovacs. A very important, almost separate part of this debate is whether we should be prescribing antidepressants to kids. So I have invited psychologist and distinguished professor of psychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine, Maria Kovacs. She's a leader in the field of childhood depression. She is in Pittsburgh. Maria, so great to have you. Thank you for being here.
Hi, Jane.
So you're one of the first in your field to study the issue of childhood depression. Talk to me about how the study of children and depression has evolved.
Yes, that's correct. I started studying this in the early 1970s, and I became interested because many people in the field believed that children could not be depressed. I used to work in adult depression, and many of my adult patients would tell me that they first got depressed when they were kids. And when I looked in the literature, there was nothing about it. So as I asked around in the field of child psychiatry, it became very clear that a lot of people didn't think that kids could get depressed. And many people attributed this to the prevailing approach to mental disorders, which was psychoanalysis. And according to some psychoanalytic principles, children couldn't get depressed. So I took a different approach. I took the same approach that we have used in adult psychiatry to try to look at this as a syndrome, as a condition, mm-hmm. and to try to describe its features and to look at other components such as familial history.
So there have been recent studies, as you well know, one specifically in the British medical journal Lancet,
yes.
That raise real red flags about the use of antidepressants in kids, calling them ineffective, potentially dangerous. Tell us the state of the debate within your profession about using antidepressants in children.
Well, I think that there is a debate both within the field of psychology and in particularly also in child psychiatry. I think there are some people who don't feel comfortable with medicating children because they're worried about the effect of psychotropic medication on the developing brain. On the other hand, just like Dr. Kramer said, there is no question that childhood onset depression is a very severe condition. Both my work and other people's work has shown that it continues. I mean, it puts these kids at very high risk for recurrent episodes of depression, both in adolescence and in adulthood. And there is also now available a number of studies that shows that when you look at adults with the depression history, those whose depression first started in childhood tend to have a more severe course and they have greater functional impairment. Mm. So I think because of what we know about childhood depression now, I think there are many people who believe that regardless of your personal convictions, antidepressants should be one of the things that you have in your armamentarium of treatment options. Now,
Marie, can I ask you quickly about this very important research that you've been doing on children?
Yes.
You've been studying children for a long time with this. You're now doing follow-up studies on the children of those
Correct.
Children you first studied. What are you finding?
Correct. Well, what we're finding, these are called high-risk studies, multi-generational high-risk studies. And one of the things that we're finding is that even the children who have not yet developed depression, whose parents have a history of depression, those high-risk children appear to have already early signs of atypical functioning when it comes to how they look at emotional stimuli, how they process emotions, how they respond to, let's say, watching a sad film, how long it takes them to go back mm-hmm. to a more normal state of feeling.
So
there's some vulnerabilities.
You're saying there are genetic links to depression? In other words, it runs in families?
Well, running in families can mean multiple things. One of them is genetic, and the other one is familial, which is just you learn it in the family. Mm. And I think that those two things are very difficult to disentangle. But can I just get back to the article that you raised?
Please.
The Lancet article last week. My interpretation of that article really wasn't as devastating as yours. I think what that article said in my reading of it is that of all of the antidepressants that they looked at, one of them, which is Prozac, fluoxetine, is the only one that they were able to show has some efficacy. Which, by the way, is nothing new because there have been evidence over the last 10 or 15 years that of all of the antidepressants that have been tried, Prozac is the one that seems to work best.
And the only one that's been approved by the FDA to treat depression in kids under 18.
I think it's another one. I think Lexapro was approved to treat kids who are 12 years old and older.
Okay.
But it seems that fluoxetine is the only one that's working.
Ah, thank you. Let's go to Pat in Detroit, Michigan. Pat, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Gene.
Hi.
My wife has a history of depression. I have a history. I'm officially obsessive compulsive. I'm on Zoloft. Our four children have all experienced obsessive compulsive disorder, and we've had them at one point, and this is a hard decision, but we put them all on Zoloft, various levels. There are three of them are still on it now, and it was miraculous. I can't tell you how transforming it was for them. My one daughter was almost non-functional, completely restored, and then recently one of my daughters was hospitalized for depression, and she's on Lexapro now, and it's an unbelievable transformation. I can't even describe it.
Yes, I think one of the things that you notice by this, by the way, it has been documented in research that the antidepressants are quite effective when it comes to pediatric anxiety disorders. So if you have children who have some sort of anxiety disorder or OCD, they tend to respond really well to these medications.
Maria, what about the side effects? I'm reading here about reward pathways that may be altered, brain plasticity and memory that may be affected.
Well, I think that there are basically two areas that have been of most concern. The black box warning that came out in 2003 mm-hmm. was because of evidence that the rate or the incidence of suicidal ideation and suicide attempts increased among children who were antidepressants. That's the bad news. On the other hand, if you look at the actual figures, and I think Dr. Kramer mentioned this also, the rate of that adverse effect is really low. So the difference between the difference in rate of suicidality between the kids who were treated with active meds versus who were not was only 1%. Which is not to say that it's acceptable, but what that really means is that I don't think it's such a devastating bit of information.
Mm. Pat it in just, Brookfield, Wisconsin. Pat, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I'm calling because I've been working with at-risk adolescents for about 30 years as a high school teacher. And I'm just shocked and appalled at the over-medication of my students when they enter my classroom. That's something I usually talk to them about. And a lot of these students, they're not clinically depressed. They have a lot of struggles in their life. You know, they have absent parents. They have maybe poverty, maybe not. They go to their family doctors, and their family doctors are putting them on antidepressants, anti-anxiety, and it's just really shocking. And just one example I had one of my teen students last year. She was pregnant. She had a miscarriage. She went to her family doctor to get checked, and he automatically put her on antidepressants. And, you know, I talked to her about that. I said, you know, you should be sad. You had something sad happen to you. But I don't know that you need medication for it.
So,
and I've also...
Can I comment on that?
Okay. Pat, thank you. Yes, Maria, go ahead.
Yes. I think one of the things that very often happens is that when we look at people's lives, we feel that some people are in certain circumstances that justifies them feeling sad. But clinical depression is more than feeling sad. And I think it's very hard to tell that somebody does or doesn't have a clinical depression just by interacting with them casually. I think you really need a detailed psychiatric evaluation. Mm-hmm. You know, there is lots of evidence that shows that at least the first episode of depression almost never occurs outside of stressors. So if you look at the history of depression, it is inevitably tied up with stressful events.
Peter Kramer, let me turn to you on that point. Maria, thank you. Pat's call makes me think of a quote I read by Dr. Mark Olson, a professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia. He says, many patients in the U.S. are inappropriately diagnosed with depression, but many who actually have it suffer without treatment. From the time they develop major depression, it takes Americans 8 years on average to seek care. So those who may not have depression get the medication, but those who actually need it wait till, you know, it's too late.
Well, let me first say it's an honor to be on the air with Maria Kovacs. She's one of the giants in the field in terms of research, and Mark Olson is. Also a terrific colleague. The kind of study that he's talking about is the one that the sort that we discussed earlier, where people may be on medication and not have a diagnosis of depression in the chart. Those are really chart studies.
Right.
In terms of children and adolescents, I think, first of all, the particular case that your caller talked about, which is after miscarriage, that is an area that's studied, and there's a lot of controversy. It may be that doctors are very quick to give antidepressants after miscarriage.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Maria Kovacs' point is also very important. I'm in a small town. I hear often about people that they're on medication for sort of slim reasons, and then for one reason or another, they or a family member comes into the office, and the story turns out to be quite grave. So I think, you need very extensive interaction with people to know whether prescribing is justified.
Let's get to Ryan in Portsmouth, Virginia. Hi, Ryan. Thanks for calling. Welcome to On Point.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I just had a comment and a question. I have a 17-year-old brother who took Prozac and switched to Celexa because he was feeling some kind of a numbness, and Celexa was a horrible experience. I mean, every side effect you could see that's listed, he went through. It made him feel suicidal, more depressed, angry outbursts, moody, no sleep.
Right.
But he switched because he was feeling completely numb on the Prozac. So my question was, as a 17-year-old, is that because of his age? And if so, is there something that you may recommend that's more conducive to his age?
Ryan, thanks. Maria Kovacs.
No, I think Dr. Kramer should answer that
question. Peter?
This is an important point. There are adverse responses to antidepressants, and one reason antidepressants don't look good in certain studies where you talk about averages is that on the same drug, a small number of people, smaller percentage, may actually do quite poorly, and others may do very well. And on average, it may look like the medicine is only a little better than a placebo, but the number of people who do very well on medicine is a great deal more. I think it's true that in younger people, the effects of these medicines are less sure. And looking at that study in The Lancet, the story wasn't as bad as what the headlines in the press say.
Correct.
Cymbalta, and I don't know why we're mentioning Cymbalta so often today. It's not, doesn't stand out for any reason. seemed to treat depression in young people about as well as some of the more adverse studies show that all antidepressants work in adults. And Prozac, in those studies, worked better in young people than it does in adults. And I think Maria Kovacs also makes a very important point, which is that the very solid research in children is really in the anxiety disorders. And maybe that the best use of the antidepressants in children is the anxiety disorders. But the whole field, to my mind, of medicating children and adolescents is one of these hard cases make bad law, where you are doing something you're reluctant to do. But the state that you find people in, they're not meeting their developmental milestones, they're suffering, the whole family's having trouble, pushes you to do whatever you can that may be effective.
In our last minute, Peter Kram, I'm just going to interrupt to ask you to sort of wrap us up here and tell our listeners what we should understand about antidepressants and when they are useful.
Well, the first thing is, consult with your doctor. There really are experts on these issues. And I think that there are a number of disorders for which antidepressants are useful. They do extraordinarily well for some people, but for many people, they give just a little lift that allows people to use then other things like relying on their friends, returning to their activities and so on. to return to an ordinary state of wellness.
And Maria Kovacs, I'll give you the last word. What would you have us know about kids and depression today?
Well, I think what I'd like to say is that it's important for people to remember that then they have these meta-analysis summaries of studies. We're dealing with groups. We're dealing with average figures. And that's not the same thing as you and your child walking into the office of a physician or a psychologist who needs to make decisions. Ultimately, what we have to do is to figure out what treatment works best for a given patient.
Excellent advice all the way around. Maria Kovacs, a psychologist, distinguished professor of psychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh Medical School. Maria Kovacs, thank you very much for your time today.
And thank you, Jane, for actually addressing this really important topic.
Thank you. Peter Kramer, psychiatrist, clinical professor of psychiatry, and author of the new book, Ordinarily Well, The Case for Antidepressants. Great to have you, Peter. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jane.
Continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, the message from the LGBT community in the wake of the attack on the Pulse nightclub. Tom's back for that. Nice to be with you this week. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom. This is On Point.